interview with Gil Carmichael, Meridian, Mississippi, March 30th, 1974.
Can we start with that?
Sure. Let me ask you, even before we get to that, what's your own background very quickly?
Who am I?
I'm a, I like to call myself a sixth generation Mississippian. And the reason I do that is because I want to establish with the people that I, well, I may talk sometimes in some areas that scare them to death, that my roots are real deep, real old here. And I'm interested in this state going someplace and doing something. So when I hit on, I wanted minimum wage as early as 1950 in Mississippi. And that scared the establishment to death. And, Carmichael talking about paying people $1 an hour back then. I was just out of school in my faces. So, just briefly and quickly, my main thrust as a political person is I want to change the attitudes of Mississippi people, and I want to, them to develop a new pride. I spent 8 years with the Wall Street Journal. In 1950, I joined that company as a salesman for subscriptions. And I was a field salesman. I traveled all over the United States for them, selling subscriptions and teaching businessmen how to read the paper. And so the Wall Street Journal had a staff that was devoted just to that, because we didn't want to change the name of the paper. We wanted to change the people's concept of the thing. As a result of working 8 years with them, I traveled, saw every bit of this country. And in 1958, I married a girl from Memphis by that time. She wanted to come back home, and I wanted to come back home. And I could see they took nothing out in California and desert country, and they made beautiful cities and everything out of it. And we got more stuff on by accident down here than a lot of the states got on purpose. But we're the lowest paid people in the country, and we're the last in all the indices. And we've got what everybody else wants. We've got the, kind of cliche with me now the way I say it, but we've got the land and the water and the climate and the minerals and the fresh air. We've got all the quality of life things that the people in the East are screaming like the devil to try to get or recover. And the Mississippian, for a long time, we thought, well, we wanted what they had, what the Eastern establishment had or the megalopolis had. And I started my politics in Mississippi about 1961. Saying, no, you don't want what they got. And, that scared them too, you know, when you start saying, well, you don't want every industry that wants to come to town, and you don't want factories that will pollute or will work on people for nothing. I'm not too much worried about pollution back in the 60s as much as I was worried about the kind of industries that were coming in here that worked as just for minimum wage. We're never going to get off the bottom if we don't break that trend. I give answers in 1,000-word responses, so you'll have to bear with me on the thing, but you ask who I was and what I am, and that's hitting at it or touching at it.
Did you come back and establish this business from scratch? Or?
When I left the Wall Street Journal in 58, I had about $6,500, and we went into business in Shreveport, Louisiana with an automobile dealer over there and started importing Fiats. And that lasted to January of 1960, and we agreed to disagree and broke up. I took about $9,000 at that time out of the company, and I went to work for Volkswagen down in New Orleans as their general sales manager for the wholesale and distribution area, Mid-South. And my wife was working teaching school, and I was making about $1,000 a month at the time, and we were saving money. I came up here in 61 with $9,500. We made a $5,000 down payment on this business here. And $2,500 down payment on a house, and went to work. And we've been in debt ever since. We were on Grand Avenue in a little metal building over there. I bought 25% interest in the business then. I have 51% of the dealership now. I have my partner is an inactive partner, a widow woman. Her husband established the business here. We've got, I'd say that $9,500 now, I owe about $1.5 million. I bought land, I'm going to build a carriage house across the street. My Chrysler place is a Mercedes-Benz and Chrysler dealership, and I'm going to move it across the street and adjunct to this. I bought the land over there. So I have three facets to my business, the Volkswagen dealership, my properties, and the Chrysler dealership. And I've been buying land and mortgaging just as heavy as I can.
Did you grow up in Mississippi?
Mm-hmm.
Where?
I was born and raised in Columbia, Mississippi, Marion County.
And how did you get involved in the Republican Party?
Well, when I went to work, well, when I got grown, I reckon. I was born and raised a Democrat. And Roosevelt put electricity in my house down in South Mississippi. In fact, Roosevelt built the outside toilets and everything when I was a child. And when I went off to school, I started reading the Wall Street Journal. And I developed I used the paper for the whole time I was in college.
College where?
Texas A&M. And, I went over there to study geology, petroleum geology. They discovered oil over here, and my daddy died. My mother married again. She married an old man, and he sent me to help me go to the first year of school. And I became Republican in that time because I take my politics kind of like I take my religion. Both of them were handed to me in the beginning, and I don't particularly like anything just given to me. I had to go back and restudy my religion, and I went back and studied and restudied my politics. And my Republican philosophy is, I'd like to call it an enlightened conservative. I believe in the free enterprise system and letting it function. I'm very happy to see wage and price controls going by the wayside. I think right now in this abnormal condition we're in right now in economics, the only thing that's going to save it is turn it loose and let it float a little bit. So that's my philosophy in the thing. My own businesses, I'm having a real tough time Volkswagen business right now. In fact, the automobile industry doesn't have a recession, it's got a depression. It's got a tough time.
Even for the small cars?
Yes, even for small cars. Volkswagen's off 30-40%. We're finishing up the day-to-day, finishing up this month.
You say you re-examine your politics and your religion. Did you change both?
I'm Episcopalian.
From what Baptist?
And no disrespect to my mother's religion or anything else like that. It didn't fit me. I understand it. I had a pretty good, my daddy was an alcoholic. I went off to school when I was 17. I've been on my own since 1944. And I just kind of put things together. I had to redo them myself. I had to do them a couple of times and reconstruct them. So,
you're how old now?
46. Born in 27.
So when you came back here, you were already a Republican.
Mm-hmm. Very much so. And one of the other things of coming back here, when you got 48,000 square miles of land, 2 million people, that's a hell of a big piece of land and awful few people. And every bit of Mississippi is usable. It's livable from one end to the other. It's not like Louisiana. Half of Louisiana is swamp. Half of Pennsylvania is rock and these kind of things. So we can support life. We got the most powerful United States senators. We cater to seniority for 100 years. And what we got, we ought to be the biggest and best. And we're the lowest paid. And this is what I campaigned on last year. Something's wrong. That's one-party system is what I say is wrong with it. Or no-party system. You can't have one and be a party. But, the old hierarchy, Bilbo, and I'm kind of related to Bilbo through the Smith family on that side. And they've done us wrong. They wasted their talents.
On what?
And just putting all our eggs in the Democrat basket. And in fact, we didn't really put our eggs in the Democrat basket. We put our eggs in the Southern Democrat basket. A lot of people thought that was part of the National Democrat Party, and it wasn't. We haven't played national party politics for a state, for its people, in my lifetime. I can't go back where we had a significant voice in the selection of the Vice President and the President of the United States at all. We have not played mainstream political politics.
What has the energy been dissipated on?
Well, I have to just call it vested interest. It's we've got a few newspapers, and I'm not hitting it. I don't like to hit the newspapers. The newspapers, you know, the merchants in a community in our little towns in Mississippi, you're elite or you're merchant owner class. Well, the only thing that we had in Mississippi were our merchants and our newspapers, and these are our elite. Well, they're benevolent people. They've been taking care of us. And don't worry about it, boy, we'll take care of you. And that's exactly what they did to us. They made my mother work in the health department in Mississippi till less than $200 a month for 20 cotton picking years, taking care of her. There's supposedly no party or one party strategy, and their benevolence. They have the only thing that they've done good is they didn't pollute or ruin this state because they didn't develop it. And we have shipped our people out of Mississippi, black and white. Our educated kids, our biggest factory in Mississippi right now is our high schools and our colleges. Our colleges, we're shipping 56% of our kids out, graduating, and shipping them right out again. You know, they're not making any money here. And we're caught in a trap of Volkswagen. You stop and we're going any direction we want to go on this thing. General Motors and Volkswagen and factories like that, they sell us the cars down here for the same price they sell them to you up in it's North Carolina. Okay. They pay our mechanics down here to work on those cars under warranty about half what they pay them up in the East. Our mechanics in the South subsidize mechanics in the North. A big percentage of the profits of General Motors or Volkswagen or anything else like that in the United States is because they work our people as little as they can, or as less, small as they can. A guy working as a security guard out here at the Navy base, it just aggravates the hell out of me. He gets paid, and the last figures I had were like $220. That same security guard, if he's in Pensacola, Florida, gets paid $240, $260 along an end. And they've got a little federal rule that says don't pay more than the prevailing rate. Well, you ain't ever going to get off the bottom if you got that kind of rule in thing. We go, and our chambers of commerce and industrial foundations go after industry. And the first thing they do to the industry is they say, man, you can get them to work down here for $1.60 an hour and you can get all you want. Well, you're never going to get off a minimum wage. The only way you get off minimum wage is, like the other day, you pass another minimum wage, you know, and raise it up slightly like that. So these are insidious things that are built into our...
You'd been in the Senate. Would you have voted for that increase?
I'd have voted for it a long time ago. I gave Eason hell on it last year. And I caught hell from some of my Republican buddies for it.
Did you... Had you run for public office before that?
Yes, I ran 3 times. I ran here in Redding. I ran for the special election for state senate, and with 10 Democrats. I beat 9 of them. The 10th one beat me, and we got a run between the two of us. And that was
was that a nonpartisan election?
Well, special election, not party designation, but I was quite obviously a Republican, and I've been very, very obviously as a Republican. 1962 downtown in front of Weidman's. One of the key women in this town slapped me on my face in front of everybody.
I was going to ask you about that. You come back here as a Republican. Isn't that a little bit masochistic?
Yeah.
Was anybody else here at all?
Yeah, there was a fellow named Gene Damon and Jim Lalonde. Gene Damon had, he's a civil engineer here in town. He had run as mayor, first Republican candidate for mayor. And he and Jim Lalonde sued the Board of Supervisors and got the county redistricted. Paid for it themselves. Cost them several thousands of dollars to do it like that. So we knew what we were doing. We knew the price we were paying. And it's been pioneering.
Why'd the woman slap you in the face?
Because she said in her statement, the answer to that, she said, I just can't understand why a nice boy like you is a Republican. Last year during my campaign, she had a tea for me. So that's how far we've come. And she introduced me to all her friends.
What was the other race you ran?
I ran 2 times for state senate. The second time they created a new senate seat of 4 counties, and I've become a pretty good threat then. So in these new 4 counties, I found out I like politics then. I enjoyed it thoroughly. And working the country stores and all the county roads and everything like that. I enjoy meeting the people. I am a politician. And, I came in with about 41% of the vote or something like that. got beat by a fellow named Joe Moser, who's a, I have to tell it like it is, I reckon, but he was a, well, he owns a liquor store here, and was a Roman Catholic. And so as a Republican running against him, he beat me. So this shows you how we were fighting and tough, and somebody else could, another Democrat running against him, he got beat on those issues. Like that. And he's a nice guy, so I like him very much.
Changes that you detected during that time as
Republican?
Yeah. I mean, did your percentages in the elections, or do Republicans tend to go pick up?
Well, those first races were teaching people that they wouldn't turn green when they voted Republican. You know, teaching people how to go to the polls and identify the Republican. It's real, you're pioneering stuff. And it was also, we had Reuben Phillips in running for governor, and that was generating grassroots actions, making people like me want to go run. And, I noticed after my campaigns, there's always three or four that would run. The mayor here worked in my campaign, helped put on a dinner for me, a fundraising dinner. Got the fever and ran. He's elected mayor. I'm really now the first Republican mayor. And Ray Whitaker up in Tupelo, which is a diehard, old National Democrat stronghold, you know, the TVA area, I think. And Ray Whitaker got elected, and he worked in his campaign. So this, that Rubel now served as a stimulus in running for the governor's race. It began to give us hope and strength at the grassroots level.
Am I right? Did he get about the same percentage of the vote that you got in 72?
I can't remember his figures. That probably was pretty close to around 40% or something like that.
38 to 40.
40%, yeah. His second race wasn't nearly as good as his first race. The second race, he didn't want to run, and he was kind of pushed in it, and he had to be begged, and it was a reluctant candidate.
You mean 67?
Yeah.
Have you seen any growth statewide in the party?
Gosh, yeah. Man, it's out there. It's the strongest. In fact, it's the biggest party in Mississippi now. I took a poll last year, and this is a statewide voter profile. It cost me $7,000 for the darn thing. And there was blood money in that campaign. But it helped plan our campaign. And an open, direct question. I'm trying to get that thing out again, some people. But people readily identify themselves. 25% of them readily identify themselves as Republicans. 24% of them identify themselves as either Mississippi Democrats or National Democrats. And the rest of them, 51%, identify themselves as independents. So as far as party loyalty and party organization right now, I'd say the biggest party in Mississippi is the Republican Party. We got some fairly good stuff to substantiate. Most of the people are going independent like they have on a national level. Everybody in Gallup was real upset about the demise of the Republican Party on the national level, but I think this is just an adjustment system. People are going independent. The hardcore political people, party people, are still damn strong. It doesn't need to be real big. 20-25% is enough. To generate candidates and function and run the elections and do your primaries. Like
yet in 71, you didn't have any candidates at all. Did you have no statewide elections? Mm-hmm. Why not?
Let me go back to the time. I'd say the main reason there was that I was trying to run and nobody believed me. I wanted to run. I wanted to be the lieutenant governor at that time. And I couldn't generate. The party just hadn't you know, looked around and saw Gil Carmichael. I've been working and been running over in state and Senate races and things like that, but I've done nothing to establish myself on a state basis. And I knocked on the door real hard and got no attention paid to me. The other thing was that Evers was this was the last race of the races, if you want to call them that way. And there's, if I'd been running, in 71, it would have been Waller and Winter against Evers and Carmichael. It would have been that type of thing, see. And just plain strategy-wise, Evers is a big Democrat, but I can just hear the vernacular of Evers and Carmichael. Got to be black man in the Republican. It was... The numbers weren't there. It didn't fall together right. So that was your prime reason that there wasn't anybody going. There was the fear of splitting the white vote during that time, too, that if a Republican ran, and I can hear the establishment, the old political, what I call the Capitol Street crowd, I can hear them saying, don't you put up anybody in that and split the vote. No problem would happen. So the Republican Party heard that sound and didn't look for anybody.
How'd you feel about that strategy?
I want to run bad.
Irrespective of ever? Sure.
If I'm a legitimate candidate, hell, well, I got to run with who's out there. And that's going to be part of next year.
Did the argument about splitting the vote have any weight with you?
Now, I believe people got... I believe in the fairness of the public and of the campaign. And I believe in the... if that's the way the candidates are generated, that's the way they're generated.
You said earlier that Mississippi put all its eggs in the Democratic basket, hadn't really got participated in national politics, yet Mississippi very much participated in national politics from 68 at the Republican National Convention in helping to nominate Richard Nixon.
Here's the board. That's one of my claims to fame. See, that's beginning to play. The only national politics have been played in Mississippi have been played by the Young Republican Party in Mississippi. And we've done it by bluff and guts.
All right, but what
we haven't had anything to work with, but we just have in our place and position.
What has the Nixon administration done to help Mississippi grow and develop?
Nixon's image to me was good in his after he got whipped out in California for governor. I saw him turn to and work as a team man and get out and work for Republican candidates around the country. And that inspired me. I like that part. When he got elected, when Mississippi delegation went to the convention, hi, son. Come on in. Well, when we went to the convention, our main strength was, and Reagan was trying to split us, was the fact that we stuck to the unit rule. And now, we had people in our delegation that really want to go with Reagan. And the women that were crying and the thing, Prentice Walker was pushing hard for it. And I just can't help but feel it was a significant time in Nixon's life. Because on his first ballot, he'd been able to split that vote, break that unit rule thing. Reagan might have won the nomination at that time. And Reagan called the ones he could out of the Mississippi delegation about 5:12 that night before we started the balloting. And Clark stayed up in the arena. And about half of us went back there. And Reagan made his last pitch to ask us to break the rule and to split the vote. And Reagan would have started something. But if I've got a claim to fame in that time, I'd like to claim it. My own statement then, and it was a general feeling of everybody there. We listened. And I served as spokesman for him at that point. Was that Mississippi didn't have much, but our word, and we committed ourselves to stay with the president, with Nixon, on the first ballot. And he'd have to run again another time. And we'd see him at a later date. And we stuck, and it went right on through. So we felt our moment of destiny there, that the Mississippi delegation did. And that's part of what I'm talking about. National politics.
Did Strom Thurmond have any influence with the Mississippi delegation?
Oh yeah, we went boat riding, and
what was the effect of that? I remember the boat ride.
I enjoyed. Did you make the boat ride?
No, I remember. I was there.
I made the boat ride, but I didn't make that.
Boy, you know, we went boat riding and had all the security guards up on the buildings and everything else like that.
I remember Strom.
Strom was on there, and Ed Nixon was on there, and I think Fred Malik back then. It was somebody else. It was a good wooing session. We enjoyed it, and we were learning as a
did it have an impact
as new politicians. No, the main thing that Clark gets credit for this, Clark Reed, and this is a significant thing. Clark's always said, "Stay loose and hang back, let them woo you," and that's what we did. And Clark and Billy Munger, they pretty much set the stage in serving as leaders. They committed themselves to Nixon. And we knew that they committed, and Clark was our leader, and we were committed to Clark. I think the boat ride was a lot of fun. It cost them some money, and we enjoyed the treatment, and we learned. We learned good politics there. And we played it again this last time, and we sure as the devil gonna play it this next time. Because we even entertained Richardson down here the other day. And we're gonna look at all the candidates, and we'll let them all come.
But Thurman didn't actually solidify.
He would like to think he did. But if there was a Southern strategy at that time, I'd say all of them, Clark Reed, Fred LaRue, Strom Thurmond, Harry Dent. Harry Dent might have had more playing strategy and ability of gluing the pieces together than anybody. I like Harry. He's got a savvy about him. He could have been significant. Strom, he was Strom's boy, of course. So if you give Dent credit, then I reckon you do give Strom credit.
You said you thought Nixon did a lot for the Republican Party during the 60s nomination.
That's right. This country's got a minority party called the Republican Party. And he was building a base in the South and building an awareness in the South for the two-party system like nobody's business. He did an awful lot of this imagery projection in 69, 70, 71, along in there. And the Southern people all across the whole thing were listening to him for signals. And whatever he said, you know, when he started living up, you're going to call it, or playing footsie with the old Southern Democrats, they took that as a signal. Now, you just didn't have them. And Eisenhower had done this to a certain extent. The patronage back when he was in office down here, and they were just temporary Republicans that took over as county chairman and things like that to get the post office appointments and things of that nature. And the young Republican Party in the South, Mississippi, they were a little bit hurt about the Kingston thing, about the spark and stuff.
You're talking about Eisenhower now?
No, I'm moving. I went back to that, just flashed back to that, and come back up to the Nixon thing. I know. The Republican Party in the United States could be a majority party right now. Had Nixon continued to play the kind of politics he played up until 68, when he got out after the governor's race, and he got out and hustled and helped and built. I don't think he was some of his Southern advisors like Fred LaRue. I think Fred LaRue gave him all advice. I think that's a lot of that strategy came from there. And that's just guesswork on my part. I don't know. But LaRue likes power and he doesn't particularly want power himself, but he likes to be all around it and connected to it. And so it was quite natural for LaRue to develop friendships with Eastland. His family goes back with him. And this is a big city politics, I reckon, in Mississippi style. If you got two sons, one's a Democrat and one's a Republican, so that you've got both sides cased. If you got two vice presidents in the bank, you let one back the Republican candidate and one other back the Democrat. Well, the Ruse role was to be the liaison between the Democrat establishment down here and the White House, and they were feeding the advice. As a result, the young party in the South and people like myself, it pushed us back and slowed us down. But it's also made us tough. That's why I feel tough now. I'll fight the whole kind of big and mess if I want to. Everybody.
Okay, let me ask you about that. How do you explain that phenomenon? Nixon's known all of his life as a party man. He performed that role for Eisenhower in the 50s, in the 60s, as you say. Now he gets in office, and he almost becomes anti-party. I would make the argument he became anti-party in the 1972 election. How do you explain that? When you had a chance to develop the Southern Republican Party.
Mm-hmm. And then see, we could have. If he had sent a signal, hey, send me some Republican congressmen, these people down here send a whole bunch of them. They just send one up there. They've done it just in mass. They gave that signal of how they'd responded when they went for Goldwater, like they did. They were emotionally keyed up and for the man. Whatever he needs, he's out in a hard time in Congress and he needs him or some Republican Congress. We'll send him some. That chunk in the minority party called the Republican Party in this country that was missing, the Southern quarter, it was there. And many of us felt it. Red Blunt felt it. He didn't realize it. That Nixon would go neutral on him like he did. And
We've sensed it. Yeah, what, this is the most Republican state in the South right now.
What does the term Southern strategy mean to you, Nixon's Southern strategy?
Well, it goes back to what was being fed into him probably by LaRue and LaRue Eastland. That friendship structure, that power system that developed in that thing, they were doing things. Well, we just like you boys. We vote the same way, and we're really together. And Nixon heard that thing and assumed that. And we were, the Mississippi Republican Party was an unknown quantity. Yeah, we hadn't won anything. We hadn't accomplished anything. And all we could do was sense the change. And pragmatic politics, I suppose, and that's the only way I can answer. Nixon looked at the thing. He took the advice from people like LaRue, and he says, hell, this is the way to go. It's too dangerous to take the other route. I don't
is that the way most Southern Republicans explain or rationalize that behavior? No? Well,
that'd be me, I reckon. I don't know. I don't know how other people explain it too much. I think most of them don't even think about it and are confused by it.
Well, let's take it to the 72 campaign, your own experience with the committee to reelect and Eastland and so on.
Let me get one thing before that, and that is, one story I've heard is that...
hope I'm not rambling too much.
No, but one thing I heard is that Clark Reed managed to wrest patronage control, at least as far as the Farmers' Home Administration, from Eastland. How did that work?
That was a major battle, that's right. Had to fight like the devil. Because the chairman, and that's a good name for Eastland, he knows his power. He knows his position, and he uses it.
Was that done over LaRue's objections?
Now, at that point, I don't think LaRue was effective at all. I think LaRue was... The Watergate thing was already beginning to evolve, and those problems, the committee to reelect was already in a... this was after the campaign, see, and fighting to get Jeffy in there. And it just... Clark had... That was one of Clark's major battles, was to get his man approved.
Well, when was he approved?
By the time slides together.
He wasn't in the first, early in the first term?
Oh. I've had my...
That's all right. We'll see Clark on Tuesday.
Yeah, get Clark's story on.
Go back to Walter's question.
It was a major fight between Eastland and... Clark.
Was Harry Dent a key figure in that?
I don't know. I don't want
to... Good last.
Harry, well, let me give you the... why I like Harry Dent. In the heat of this campaign of mine, people began to come forth and endorse me. And Harry Dent, still in the White House, came down here and endorsed me and stood up and made a... Ellie's a good one. Bill Brock did, and Tennessee Governor Field Time did. And then even old Lowell Weicker. I had 13 senators up there. Just in the face of the president's support thing, went the other way. So, and Harry, again, I think Harry is a party builder, a team player on that thing. He didn't have to do what he did at the time, and it helped me significantly. It helped me emotionally to have that type of support coming out of it. Two or three. Secretary Schultz has been very fair to me, George Schultz. I've worked with him on the Public Education Committee during the desegregation, helping to take Mississippi through the crisis back in 71, in that area there.
When you did that statewide poll, did it show you the margin of Nixon's victory early in that campaign? Mm-hmm. What did it show pretty much?
As I remember, 78% of the time.
Okay, so you knew that Nixon was going to carry the state big at about
10%. That's right.
Did you at any point talk to the committee to reelect or anybody else about getting some resources?
Sure, boy. I went to the Senate committee and begged Berenstain, I think. Just flat begged him.
Well, they had the money. Why didn't they give it to you?
They ended up contracting and giving me a little bit. I think they got $25,000. I don't know. I'd have to ask them why they didn't give it to me. Some of the earlier write-ups on this campaign, as they analyze the candidates around the country, man, they didn't even mention my name or anything. They just said Senator Easton run against a Republican opponent and nothing was not much trouble or difficulty or anything like that. And, some of these magazines and books that are put out on the campaign appraisals and forecasts. So if they were reading any of that stuff, and if they're listening to LaRue threatening, he just on that cotton picking phone. He said I was going to get wiped out, and I was running myself politically, and I was making everybody mad and angry, and I shouldn't do that. Well, this is the dope that the Senate committee was probably being fed, the Congressional committee. Only by accident did I find out about the Congressional school up there. That you know where you go study at Kansas school. And I went, got invited, and that's when they, several of the, what I call the good guys, Senator Chicago, began to hear that this boy down here was being left out. The same thing was happening over in Arkansas to that boy over there. And at least he had Rockefeller over there to raise hell for him. Rockefeller just climbed a tree for him. And as a result, we began to get some attention in that time. I get off the question.
Was the assessment of Republicans in this state the same as
Washington? They were in a dilemma. Clark may give you a version on this thing. I'll give you mine. James Meredith had come back down here and settled down. And he'd run in New York or almost run in New York or something else. I think we had some signal or something. But Meredith came down here and announced as a Republican for the United States Senate. I got a feeling Jim Eastman would love to run against Meredith, and Meredith would love to run against Jim Eastman. I think that would have been fun. But those of us that were trying to build a party didn't care for our party to be used as a darn vehicle for two people loving to fight each other. And the question then became, you know, by the leadership, and I'm one of them, what do we do? Are we going to let Meredith just, are we going to sit by the side here and let Meredith take the banner and be the Republican candidate? Or do we have a Republican candidate? We've run against Easton before in the French Walker's case. And Easton's no friend of the Mississippi Republican Party. And that darn thing to help build it. Then he's tried to destroy it. And we've felt his hot breath on our necks many times trying to get rid of him. So we had to come up with a decision. Do we have a candidate? And do we forfeit the nomination to Meredith and let Meredith carry the banner for the Republican Party against Easton like that? And the answer was no. Let's see if we got a candidate. And we started looking. I was on the candidate committee. And we looked at several different types of candidates, and some of them had just wanted to build a reputation for themselves or a name. And one day we were sitting over in the airport in Jackson and meeting them over there, interviewing the fellow that George wants. He won't know how much money we put down, how much we could raise. And one of us said, myself or somebody, said, you know, we may be picking the next senator of the United States from Mississippi. It kind of shocked us. Shocked every one of us. Because we put our numbers together, Prentice had gotten 30-something percent of the vote all by himself, in a sense. Just running against Easton back then, and throwing a congressional seat that we just run, he alienated the Republicans in the state and made the Democrats mad that voted for him. But looking back at the numbers, there was an anti-Easton vote of 30%. Just sitting. We began to put the numbers together, and we knew the strong Nixon vote that you're talking about. We felt that at the time. So the mathematics are there. Somebody gets in there and run, and it could have been a Goldwater situation again, you know. Bang, picked them up like that. So they started looking seriously then. And I'd fussed at them for not paying attention to them and want to run loose in the governor. Then Clark started putting pressure on me. I was working the highway bill through the legislature at the time. I was president of a political organization over here, East Mississippi Council. And it went on for about 5 or 6 weeks. I finally had to admit that if I was a politician, if I was legitimate about wanting to be a public servant, then I had to find out whether I had the guts enough to take on the tiger. also a theorist in this sense. The young Republican Party of Mississippi or in the South is worth a damn. It's going to have to fight every single giant it's got in opposition. Decent giant. So it fell my lot, fell the party's lot, and that's where we went.
Is there anything that might have been done that would have enabled you to win it? Yeah. You don't think
a couple of things. Well, one is that had the younger, this is all theory, not theory either, but just hindsight. The young party didn't realize how big it was. They didn't realize how big the Senate was. They didn't know how to fight a major campaign. They didn't know how to fight a mean campaign, either a tough campaign. I spent, out of the 8 months of running, 7 months hard running, I spent 5 months selling the Republicans on going. I'd have to go back down to the Gulfport and resell them. I'd sell them, go back down there 2 weeks later, and they'd disappear and go sell them again. We'd start all over again. I spent a good percentage of my time generating the basic Republicans. I was, I didn't need a whole lot of money. I think easily spent around $500,000 or $600,000. I spent around $150,000. But, you know, when you're little, like Volkswagen, for example, when you're fighting General Motors or something like that, you use rifle shots instead of cannons. So I knew how to use the media. I worked the media hard from a availability standpoint. I traveled 100,000 miles. I put 450 hours on an airplane, single-engine airplane. I had run at least 3 to 5 speeches a day. We saw 100,000 people. We shook hands with that man. We always held a press conference. I'd go to the press if they didn't come to me. I'd go find them. We'd talk. And that was equal to any kind of massive advertising campaign. The final thing that I should have done, my gut told me to start I wanted to do a 30-minute talk show. And that's against all the political laws. Everybody's put by 30-second spots, and build up to crescendo and do it all the last night, or you work from the campaign back, that stuff. That was, for my type of candidacy, that was wrong. People vote for who they know. And I wanted a 30-minute talk show where I tell them what I believe and what I feel. And we did one, cold turkey. I finally decided to do it. And this is my feeling, and I take credit for it. And we did a documentary, I've got the tapes on the thing, about why I'm running, what's going on. I've pulled y'all a couple of these out. Those cost a half a cent a piece. But we did a television show that talked about this to a group of people, a rap session type thing. And we used just local talent. I didn't have any big agency or anything else like that. And we did two of those 30-minute things. And we played them. We could run them in Columbus, Mississippi on TV for $246 for 30 minutes. Well, you'd lose half your audience, but the half that stayed there would you learn. And they were significant. And we passed out 750,000 of those things. We printed 3 different versions of those things, and they cost half to 750,000 a piece. And we just...
But what was missing to make it a winner?
I should have started 2 weeks earlier on those TV shows. I had it. The one thing that I don't know for sure, but one of Easton's key Democrats in his campaign came to me later and said, our poll showed that on October the 1st you had us beat. He said, you'd already done it. And that's when you scared the hell out of us. You had too big a percentage at that point. And that's when they poured the money on, and they poured it. Now, I could not buy a television in New Orleans and Mobile. And if you look at the state of Mississippi, where I ran my TVs, at the Gulfport TV station here, Hattiesburg here, the 3 Jackson stations here, and Meridian station, 2 below stations, television, and I worked these Mississippi stations. Now, I didn't work Mobile stations, and I didn't work New Orleans and Baton Rouge stations and Memphis stations. Here, it was these things. Telling people like this is a tabloid designed after the Inquirer type thing. It was the documentaries. The documentaries were important. Once they got started in this thing, the money started coming in.
Why didn't you use, say, to Memphis?
I didn't have enough time to buy some more time down here. I ran out of time.
You ran out of time rather than
early.
Money?
Huh?
Money was not the problem.
No, I was generating money.
What happened? What was the incident in which Agnew was here at Snowdew on his visit to Mississippi?
We knew going in we were underdog, and we kept getting living proof of it, just bang, bang, bang. Nothing surprised us. Hell, it didn't make any difference who came against us. Kleindienst came down here and spent the night with Eastland. Butts came down here and said, this is my kind of senator. Really, this is what kind of guy we need up here in a division like that. We had gotten used to I was trained in the Wall Street Journal that everything that you say has two reactions, or everything that happens to you has two reactions. And if you'll stop and think, you've got two ways to go on any situation. Well, how do you take the Agnew situation, or the Butts situation, or the Kleindienst thing? What we ended up, and this was legitimate, the Kleindienst, Butts, Agnew, Nixon, the whole thing, the Watergate crowd and things like that, there is a bogus Republican Party in Mississippi that was trying to take over the system, and it's Eastland related. They were all Eastland friends, and you could almost feel his organization calling the shots and things like that. Well, I identified that group, and it began, the David and Goliath type of feeling on this thing came out. And we played on it. We took the Agnew thing. All we wanted to do in the Agnew thing, once we found out, I knew about it a week ahead of time, and it hurt bad. Because he had great imagery down here. But then we sat down and said, how in the hell do you turn this thing around? And that's when I identified the bogus Republican Party. We got half the front pages in most cases. We got the top part, and Agnew got the bottom part. We took the Agnew ignoring of us.
What did Agnew
do?
It
gave us name identification. Our name identification just went like this. Fun.
But what did Agnew do?
He met over here in Jackson in the front of the state capitol in a great big patriotic thing, and identified the Republican candidates for Congress as fine, wonderful people, and we need them up there in Washington. And I was standing down the street, and another